The protesters marched down the street with the donkey of Kasoor, representing then Pakistani Prime Minister Khwaja Nazimuddin. He was paraded through the lanes, ridden by an effigy of Foreign Minister Muhammad Zafrullah Khan. Scandalous words and slander were hurled at Mirza Bashiruddin, the second caliph of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community. Elegant theocratic arguments had given way to Lahore's famously colourful vernacular, the judicial investigation of the 1953 riot noted. Exactly 70 years ago this month, and long before Twitter memes were invented, Islamist-led populism and the political elite of the fledgling Pakistani Republic were locked in a battle to decide whether Pakistan should be led by rural grandees and whiskey-sipping generals or the country's clerics. Dozens died in mob violence and police firing in 1953, before military rule was first imposed. 5 years later, that very crisis led to Field Marshal Ayub Khan staging Pakistan's first coup d'etat in 1958. And the war for the idea of Pakistan continues uninterrupted. Fresh from winning the Battle of Zaman Park, the botched police effort to compel Imran Khan to appear in court, the former Prime Minister is planning fresh rallies at the historic Minare, Pakistan. Since 2008, Pakistan has operated on a kind of hybrid political order, with chosen political proxies of the military being secured in charge of government. Imran, helped to power by the generals, was ignominiously evicted by them last year. But for the first time, he's fighting back by seeking to force elections that many believe he's certain to win. In the process, he's exposing the country to grave dangers at a time of deep economic and ideological crisis. From 1950 on, communal violence grew across Pakistan's Punjab province. Not Hindu-Muslim violence, but targeting the heterodox Ahmadi minority. Ahmadi preachers and religious gatherings were assaulted in Okada district by armed mobs. The community's mosque in Samundri was burned down. There were calls to deny access to drinking water and even space in graveyards. Large mobs turned out in Gujranwala to stage mock funerals for Pakistan's suave foreign minister, an Ahmadi, and rewards were announced for his assassination publicly. The anti-Ahmadi movement also saw growing anger against the elite at large. The Sargodha cleric Ahmad Khan, the judicial investigation recorded, even lashed out at military officers for spending time dancing and drinking. Led by the Majlis-e-Ehrar, which had opposed partition and the creation of Pakistan, the movement of 1950 was a reassertion of power by the clerics who wielded power in the streets and neighborhoods of northern India. They promised a new kind of regime which would reconstruct the imagined Islamic utopia of Prophet Muhammad's time. The country's proto-constitution, the Objectives Resolution of 1949, passed under Prime Minister Liaquat Ali Khan, ceded at least some of these demands. The resolution promised freedom of faith, but it also insisted that public life would be governed in accordance with Islam and asserted that, I quote, sovereignty over the entire universe belongs to Allah. Sovereignty, that is, was religious, not of the political order or the nation state. Leaders of the Majlis-e-Ehrar claimed the Objectives Resolution was an incomplete manifesto for nationhood. The organization wanted that Ahmadis be declared apostates, but there was more. Figures like Maulana Alim Ilahi demanded an Islamic state with the Sharia, not the nation, as its basis. Laws and constitution themselves needed clerical authorship, the mullahs argued. The clerics who later deposed to the judicial commission were divided on most issues, but the core of their argument was the demand for a theological order. Fearing the emergence of wide opposition, the Punjab government dithered in response to the crisis. The province sought to toss the issue to the central government, asking it to discuss these demands with the cleric. The central government, in turn, demanded Punjab impose order, an end it tried somewhat ineffectually to achieve by bribing large numbers of local newspapers with funds purloined from the adult education budget. Well, that didn't work. The riot of 1953 that tore apart Lahore forced the central government to finally act. It ordered the imposition of martial law in several cities, Pakistan's first experience, and the clerical protests were stilled. The Islamist leader Sayyid Abdul Allah Maududi was given a death sentence, which was later rescinded. The military, meanwhile, realized civilian leaders were ineffective and divided. And under Ayub Khan, the army simply seized power, establishing a Praetorian order that still scars Pakistan's polity. Each ruler, though, military or civilian, continued to give ground to the clerical cause. Ayub, though he sought to break the authority of the clerics, institutionalized Islam within the state to strengthen his authority. Former Prime Minister Zulfikar Ali Bhutto finally proscribed the Ahmadi faith and vowed war without end over Kashmir. General Muhammad Zia-ul-Haq gave the clerics an institutional role in lawmaking. Imran's core slogan today, building a Riyasat-e-Medina, invokes the movement of 1953, a rebellion of the rural petty bourgeoisie and struggling informal sector workers against the power of both landed wealth and the new English-speaking or Urdu-speaking elite. The Pakistan Imran promises is a utopia where scholars Kenneth Shakil and Ihsan Yilmaz argue pious citizens will receive housing, healthcare, and jobs. The former Prime Minister dramatically expanded religious education and supported the Taliban's war on the West, after all. Facing this polemic, Imran's opponents seem unable to argue for the idea of a secular, modernizing republic. Twitter battles on Pakistani politics, anthropologists Ghazal Asif Farooqi and Natasha Raheja have perceptively noted, still involve communal invective. Imran has been represented as Shiva and his most visible opponent Maryam Nawaz Sharif as Kali. Loss of religious legitimacy clearly comes with a high political price. Like in 1953, economist Uzair Yunus has noted, a fractious and ineffective civilian order runs the country. The government has delayed implementing a desperately needed International Monetary Fund bailout for fear of the harsh impacts it would have on citizens. This self-defeating strategy has compelled the Pakistan government to delay provincial elections in the face of Supreme Court orders. Faced with the prospect that the military could saw down the branch on which it placed him, Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif is hurling patronage at the generals. The military has been given recently a staggering 45,000 acres for a corporate farming project. The National Assembly has expanded the country's draconian blasphemy laws in a bid to placate the religious right. Foreign Minister Bilawal Zardari Bhutto has focused his diplomatic energies on polemics about Kashmir. For its part, the Pakistan military, facing an ever-growing insurgency from jihadists it helped nurture, has excellent reason to avoid staging a coup. It has no solutions to the economic crisis, nor to the political meltdown. The chances are, however, that Imran's demagogic populism will soon compel them to exercise their authority or make some terms for his return. Either way, this crisis won't solve Pakistan's core problem. As long as we rely on the hammer when a file is needed and press Islam into service to solve situations it was never intended to solve, frustration and disappointment must dog our steps. Justices Muhammad Munir and M.R. Kayani, the judges who investigated the 1953 crisis, wrote. I'm Praveen Swami, and I'm National Security Editor of The Print. Thank you for watching Security Code.